So it's been nice to be sitting here today with you all. I was struck that today that with all the people we have, the room felt very still to me in the course of the sittings. I was a little bit surprised how quiet and still it seemed. Maybe each of you individually didn't feel that way inside, but it felt collectively quite still. And I hope that the amount of instructions and guidance for the sittings struck the right balance between for the different levels of experience that's here in the room today. There are some people who have done a lot of practice and some people who are pretty new at it. So I tried to intuit the right balance, and I hope that was the case. I wanted to spend a little bit of time today talking about the discourse that the Buddha gave for mindfulness practice. It's called usually in English it's called the Discourse on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta. And it's the kind of the origin or the mother of all the various forms of Vipassana practices. And there are many, many different kinds of Vipassana practices. And some of them, you kind of wonder how they could have gotten it from that discourse. It seems a bit far-fetched sometimes, but the discourse actually has a lot of practices within it. And some of you who've done the kind of IMS Spirit Rock style of practice that I teach would also maybe be surprised if you never read the sutra, the discourse, to read it for the first time. You might say, well, wait a minute, there's a lot going, it's a lot, it gives a lot of different instructions and practices that I've never heard of. You know, what's going on here? So I thought I'd just kind of talk about it some, this famous discourse. It's in some sense central to the Vipassana movement. The discourse begins with the Buddha saying, "There is one way, O monks, for the purification of beings, for the ending of sorrow, lamentation, grief, and despair, for following the true way, and for the attainment of release, of nirvana, nibbana." Something like that it begins. And that's a very strong beginning, kind of promise that there's one way. The expression, "there's one way," is problematic for some people because it implies this is the only true way and all other ways are not the one way. Though I think in the spirit of the way the Buddha usually taught, it's hard to interpret it that way. One way that one person that translated it, he translates that there is a one way on the road to the purification of beings, to the overcoming of sorrow, lamentation, grief, and despair. In other words, it's a one-way road. Once you start the practice of mindfulness, you're only going to go in one direction. And that's why it's a one-way road. It's not the one way, it's a one-way road. And as Chögyam Trungpa said apparently a number of times, you're probably better off not starting the path. But if you got yourself on it, you better not turn back. You better not stop. there's one way. There's a one-way road. For the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow, lamentation, grief, and despair. For following the true road, the true path for attaining nibbana. And what is that way? That is practicing the four foundations of mindfulness. And how do you practice the four foundations of mindfulness? Practicing mindfulness of the body in the body, feelings in the feelings, states of consciousness in states of consciousness, and dharmas in the dharmas. The four foundations of mindfulness is the common translation into English of Satipatthana. Sati means mindfulness or recollection or awareness. Patthana, Satipatthana, comes from the root of the word to establish or to stand. But some people translate it as the frames of reference, the four domains of mindfulness, the four fields of mindfulness, the four references for awareness, four frames of awareness, frames of reference. There are four interesting ways or useful ways for investigating our experience in the present moment. And the given in that is that you've somehow managed to get yourself in the present moment. And once you're able to stay in the present moment, then you can investigate the present moment from these four different domains or areas. And these are particularly useful areas to help you overcome sorrow, lamentation, despair, grief, for the purification of beings. So there are four frames of reference for our experience. And the Buddha goes on, how does one do this? One goes off into the forest, it says in the text, to the foot of a tree, to an empty building, an empty room, and sits down cross-legged with the back upright and establishes awareness in front of oneself or with oneself right here. In the beginning of that one goes to the forest, to the foot of a tree, to an empty room, has a number of different connotations or implications. One is you want to go someplace to do the practice where the normal stimulus, our normal involvements in the world are put on hold for a while. The normal props for our lives, the normal way in which we get stimulated, the normal ways in which we get excited, normal ways in which we build up a sense of self, the normal ways in which we get entertained, the normal ways in which we react to the world, are somehow put aside for a little bit. Because many of us, are over-caffeinated in our society, and we don't just caffeinate ourselves with coffee and tea, but we're caffeinated by all the stimulus that we get, all the involvement, all the activities, all the ways in which we distract ourselves from ourselves or build ourselves up or entertain ourselves. And you want to go someplace where there isn't all that activity and all the stimulus. And the reason for that, not that it's necessarily bad, all those things, but all those activities mask or hide who ourselves from ourselves. If we're always involved with the external world and always involved with the stimulus the world provides, it's sometimes very hard to really find out who we are ourselves, discover who we are in our nakedness, in our fullness, in our undistracted way. So the instruction is to go someplace where you're not going to have all these stimulus. And then sit up straight, be upright. And I love this expression, sit up straight and be upright. Because aside from its literal meanings, it means establish yourself in an upright fashion. Be an upright kind of person in the midst of your experience. Be self-reliant. Find some strength where you can sit upright regardless of what arises and what passes. Don't be knocked over by experience. Don't be ashamed of who you are. Don't be embarrassed. Don't be shy. Just be upright in a kind of straightforward, good old American way. Upright there. Here you are. And then it also says, it gives the instruction, put aside something like greed and desire for things of the world. So not only do you go someplace into the forest or into an empty room, this qualifies as an empty room, but you also put aside your hankering for things of the world. Again, not necessarily that it's bad to want things, but for temporarily you're going to put aside your desires for the PlayStation 2. Which I have no idea actually what it is, but I saw it in the paper that's come out. Or whatever your hankering is, whatever your desires are, you somehow temporarily put them aside. And to say temporarily maybe is kind of makes it easier for us to do that, but we have the instruction, all the things that we want before our lives, all the greatest relationship, the greatest recreational opportunities, the greatest financial security, whatever it is we want, we temporarily put that aside in this empty room that we go to. For the same reason, we want to discover who we are. Deep, more in our core, underneath our desires, underneath the wishes, underneath the things we think we need to support our life. Because in a sense, the premise is that in freedom, you don't need anything. When you're liberated and free, when you're most deeply at peace with yourself, you need nothing for that peace. That in a sense, innate in each of us is the capacity to be at ease and be at peace without any involvement from things in the world around us. And that is quite a challenge for many of us who spend a lifetime looking outside of ourselves for support and for security, for happiness. But I think most of you know that most spiritual traditions, especially the more mystical side of traditions, will stress that the things of the world will not provide you with the greatest happiness. You have to somehow turn away from that in order to find it within. So the Buddha says, go to the forest, foot of a tree, to an empty room. Put aside for the time being all desire and hankering for things of the world. Sit yourself down cross-legged. Establish yourself upright. So for many people, for most of us, a lot of the practice initially is beginning to find ourselves in the present moment, to have some interest and some commitment that it's useful to be in the present moment. If for some people a big part of the practice, to really be deeply convinced that it's more important and more useful for you, it's going to serve you much more to be here and present for what's happening in the present moment than it is to be here and planning what you're going to do during the week or reviewing some conversation you've had in the past or some event in the past. That it's more useful for you, it serves you much better to establish yourself here in the present moment, in what's happening for you in the present. If you can really be convinced about that, the practice will go a lot smoother. Not that it'll go smoothly, not that it's easy then to be in the present, but if you really understand that it's really valuable and important to be present, then you're not going to be so easily seduced by the wonderful attraction of memories and planning and fantasy and whatever. And then a lot of the practice is learning how to train the attention in the present moment, bring it back to the present. Notice how it wanders off, coming back. Notice how it wanders off. Notice when it wanders off, and we notice that, to recognize that there is a moment of mindfulness, that recognition, and not then to barrage yourself with self-criticism or agendas of what you need to do, but rather massage or promote that mindfulness that's already right there, that natural mindfulness. That was a very important point I tried to make today. I hope that some of you understood what I was saying this morning. So in the first instruction, the Buddha says, instructs the practitioner to become aware of the breathing. Just very simply, matter-of-factly, be aware of your breathing as it is. When you breathe in short, be aware of your breathing in a short breath. When you're breathing out long, be aware of your breathing out a long breath. And for me, this mostly means just be aware of the breath as it is. Train your attention to be in the present moment on the breath. The breath is, for the most part, always happening. So it's a great place to train ourselves on something that's happening in the present moment. So we develop the capacity to be present on the breathing. For most people, that works really well. Occasionally, there's people for whom the breath is not particularly good focus of meditation for them. And then they might do something else as the primary focus. The meditation on listening that we did in the last sitting is one of those alternatives. And so every time the mind wanders away, you come back to listening. And just, you can get very spacious and very peaceful just listening to sounds, very, very much in the present moment. The Buddha then went on to say that you can do something else with the breath, and that is you can be aware of the whole breath body. The whole, kind of whatever that means for you, the whole sense of the, as wide and global sense of breathing as you can in the body. Aware of the breath kind of expanding up into the shoulders, into the neck, the whole torso, the back rib cage, the diaphragm, the stomach, the very subtle pressure or weight you might feel as you inhale down into your sitting bones and the contact with the ground. You might feel a little shift in pressure as you're breathing in and out if you're very attentive. Some people will feel a ripple of sensation down their legs. Just wherever you feel the breath body, whatever sensations are rippling out from your breathing, you're open to all of it, not just simply to one particular focus. And then Buddha went on to say, being aware of the whole breath body, you can also use that whole breath body to calm yourself, to relax yourself. So breathing in through the whole body, I calm the body. You calm the body, especially as you breathe out, to relax the body. It really helps with mindfulness and presence if you can be somewhat relaxed. So the Buddha said, use the breath as a way of helping you relax, get calmer. Not just simply the mind, but calm your body. Begin to let go of the tension in your body and its holding. So be aware of the breath as it is. Be aware of the whole breath body as it is. And then use that breath body as a massage to kind of ease the body, to soothe the body, to settle the body. Being very careful as you do that, that you don't get attached to comfort or calm, but just to some to modicum of getting yourself established in the present moment. It's helpful to get calm yourself down and relax. And if your mind is agitated and not and very distracted, to know that you have some pleasant, relaxing technique with the breath can make it a lot easier to settle down. Oh, I'll go to that wonderful practice I have, feeling the whole breath body, and then letting the breath that kind of massage me and relax me. If you only do that, it's a dead end. So you don't want to just do that, but initially when you first sit down for a while, it could be very useful. And the Buddha went on to say, to talk more about the first foundation of mindfulness, first frame of reference that's useful to pay attention to, which is the frame of reference of your body, your physical experience. And the Buddha gives a lot of focus on mindfulness of the body. And learn to pay attention to your body in different ways, from different angles, different situations. So you start off by talking mindfulness of the breath, which is a function of mindfulness of the body. And then he talked about mindfulness of your posture, mindfulness of your activities. When you're standing, be aware of your standing. When you're walking, be aware of when you're walking. When you're reaching to lift something up, be aware of reaching, be aware of lifting something up. When you go to the toilet, be aware of going to the toilet. When you want to put on your clothes, be aware of putting on your clothes. Be aware of very simple activities that you do. If the Buddha was alive today, he probably would have inserted, when you're driving, be aware of driving. Be aware of what you're doing, the activity you're doing while you're doing them. But in particular, pay attention to what goes on in your body, the physical posture, the physical activities involved in your various activities you do. Be in touch with your body as you go about doing activity. I'm very fond of the story when I was in the monastery in Japan. I went into the kitchen one day to talk to the cook, and he was chopping vegetables. And so I asked him something. He put down the knife. It wasn't very important. I was just worth chatting, kind of. He put down the knife, faced me, and answered me. When he finished talking to me, he picked up his knife and continued chopping. And then when I asked him another question, he put down the knife, faced me, talked to me. When he finished talking, he picked up his knife and started chopping again. And since I'm kind of slow, I guess, you know, a third time I was going to ask him a question, and he put down his knife and he said, you know, Gil, it's nice to talk, but I'm actually supposed to be cooking right now. And when I do things here in the monastery, I try just to do one thing at a time. And when I'm cooking, I really try to be there for my activity of chopping the vegetables. So, you know, I can either focus on my chopping or I can focus on talking to you. But if I focus on talking with you, I can't chop my vegetables in this full way that I want to practice with here in the monastery. So, you know, what do you want to do? Well, who was I to interfere with his practice? So this idea of kind of really being there for the activity you're doing. The Buddha then talked about being aware The word analysis, analytically, is probably not a very good one, but to begin focusing on studying, investigating, when we're present for our bodily sensations, what are those sensations? To get really intimate, really close. Not only just to be aware of your body globally and the activities it does, and the sensations that arise, but what can you get in there and really understand something about those sensations, to investigate them. When there's hardness, be aware there's hardness. When there's feelings of softness, be aware of softness. When there's heat, be aware of the temperature, coolness. When there's a feeling of movement in the body, feel the movement within the body. When there's a feeling of pulling, or tension, or cohesiveness in the body, be aware of that pulling, or that tautness, or tightness. When there's vibration, be aware of vibration, movement. Be aware of the different kinds of sensations that happen. And kind of develop your vocabulary, in a sense, to discover all the various ways in which the body speaks to you through its sensations. So it's kind of a sensory awareness exercise. And the Buddha was suggesting this is a very important perspective or angle for exploring our lives. Then he had a few other practices which are very seldomly taught here in the West around the body. One of them is to spend some time either by visualizing or by actually going and visiting a corpse. Go and study. Back in ancient India, the story goes, corpses were much more commonly, you know, than they are these days, where we have this hyper-sanitized society we live in. But there they just, you know, dump the corpses out in the charnel ground. People died at home for the most part, so that it was much more common. And the Buddha suggested, go spend some time watching a corpse or seeing what happens to a corpse over time as it decays. So this seems like a bit of a gruesome and morbid Buddhist practice, and why would anybody in their right mind do this? But to spend some time reflecting on the nature of the body, that it exists, mental decay, and the reflection on death, has historically been a very powerful practice to help us maybe appreciate our life more, to motivate us, to understand something about the nature of this wonderful, precious life force that we have while we have it. And it's meant to kind of accentuate or sharpen our senses of the present moment rather than to dull it. If it dulls it, then don't do that kind of practice for you. But if it sharpens your senses, it's like if you've been in an accident or near collision, and maybe you were hopefully just fine at the end of the accident, but somehow the preciousness of life, you know, how tenuous it is, heightens your alertness, heightens your awareness, heightens your appreciation of the sound of the rain. Normally we might be so concerned about PlayStation 2 that we'd hardly even notice the sound of the rain, right? This seems so important. And this, I read that the paper that maybe they didn't make enough for me by the time I get to the store. So I completely lose touch with this, how wonderful it is to hear the sound of the rain. So this meditation on death is included in one of the foundations of mindfulness on the body. And then there's another practice. So there's always kind of a whole slew of kind of repertoire of different kinds of ways of learning to be in your body, become familiar with your body, beginning experiencing your life through the point of view of the body. Many of us lose touch with our body, or if we're in touch with our body, sometimes it's in unsavory or unwholesome ways. There was an article in the paper this last week about, was it Chile or Argentina, where this huge obsession there of women having slim bodies, I mean much more than what we have here in our culture. So it's a different way of being in touch with the body, is being obsessed with body image. So the Buddha, you know, the practice of the foundation of mindfulness of the body is to learn how to step out of the body image concern we have and experience the body in and of itself, how it is. Then the second frame of reference that the Buddha talked about is the feeling tones of our experience. And this can seem a little bit odd when you first hear about it. The feeling tone The teaching is that in every experience we have, there is one of three kinds of feeling tones. And these are morally neutral. It's nothing to do with right or wrong or preferences or our likes or dislikes. Just in the nature of the experience itself, it's very kind of rudimentary, kind of foundation. So any experience we have will either have the nature of being a pleasant experience or an unpleasant experience or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It's perhaps what the Buddha was teaching is a little bit more nuanced than that, because we translated that, the words as pleasant or unpleasant or neither. But the words are actually in the sutta are dukkha and sukha. And dukkha usually is a translation as suffering, and sukha is happiness. So the feeling tone is either happy or unhappy. So we translate it as pleasant or unpleasant, but why the Buddha chose sukha and dukkha, I don't know. And why it's so useful to start paying attention to the pleasant, unpleasant, or neither unpleasant or unpleasant feeling tone of experience is many of us react to the feeling tone of the experience. Often the first reaction we have to our life is to the feeling tone of the experience. Something is unpleasant, we react to it, we pull away from it, we lash out at it. Something is pleasant, we try to hold on to it, we try to grab it, we want more of it. Something is neither pleasant or unpleasant, sometimes we react to that, we get bored. And so we react in some way to the boredom. It's actually quite humbling to pay careful attention and notice how quick our reactivity is to whether things are pleasant or unpleasant. It's almost like we're amoebas. We react, pull away, we go towards. Many of us think we're creatures of higher thinking. And, we are to some degree. But it's amazing, if you really pay attention to the moment-to-moment ways in which we react to the world, how often it has to do with whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. And because it's such a common reaction, a common source of reactivity, the pleasant, unpleasant experience, the Buddha says it's actually very useful to use that as a frame of reference. Start paying attention to whether things are pleasant or unpleasant in and of themselves. It's not a judgment, it's not a valuation, it's just simply when someone rubs the chalk across the chalkboard in the wrong way, is that unpleasant or pleasant? It's unpleasant. The sound of the rain, in and of itself, is it pleasant or unpleasant? If you get involved with your associated ideas, the meaning of the rains, it gets more complicated. You might think, oh my God, I forgot my rain boots and my rain jacket and my umbrella and it's raining and I left the cat out and the clothes are drying on the clothesline. I suppose, how many of you have clotheslines at home? Two people, huh? Three? A few have, huh? I have one. We use it even. But anyway, sometimes I feel my examples are anachronistic. I realized some years ago I was regularly using the example of people washing their dishes. I assumed everyone washed their dishes, and then we stayed at someone's house and they had a washing machine. And I realized they didn't wash their dishes, they used a dishwasher, so I stopped using that as an example for mindfulness and activity. So the rain, we hear the sound of the rain, and maybe it's pleasant, that sound. But we get caught up in our thoughts about what it means. And we say, oh, I hate the rain because this means that I can't go running because I love to run. I can't go running in the rain, of course, or whatever. But pleasant and unpleasantness, just to stay with the raw experience of that. Also, the pleasant unpleasantness of a thought. Certain thoughts are pleasant or unpleasant. And sometimes we're simply reacting to the thought of pleasant or unpleasantness. And it's very humbling and very powerful to start seeing how we react to pleasant and unpleasant feeling sensations within us. And to learn that we don't have to react to pleasant or unpleasant is one of the, for some people, some of the most powerful lessons in mindfulness practice. That you can allow an unpleasant sensation be there, and it's okay. You don't have to come to any conclusions of what it means that it's there. Just, oh, it's unpleasant. You don't have to like your experience. You don't have to like it. You can just be mindful of it. And in that mindfulness, become free of it. The third foundation of mindfulness, the third reference for frame of reference for awareness, is called citta in Pali. Consciousness, sometimes in English. States of mind, probably better translation into English. It's kind of a state, the general state of mind you have. Not the particular emotion or mental content that arises, but the general state of mind that you have. The argument being that most of the time there's a filter of a mood or state of mind or emotional state for our thinking, for our perceptions. And it's useful to become aware of that mood or that general global state of mind which is operating. When you're calm, be aware of when you're calm. When there's a mood of desire, be aware of desiring. When there's a mood of aversion or state of mind of aversion, be aware of the aversion or the hate. When there's a concentrated or calm state of mind, be aware of concentration or calm. When there's agitation, be aware of agitation. It's really fascinating to see how, based on our moods, we'll have different interpretations of life. You never want to talk philosophy with a philosopher when he's angry, he or she is angry. You never want to, better, it's best not to talk politics to someone whose politics is being seen through the filter of their anger, their hostility. When you're in the throes of desire, or in the throes of aversion and anger, maybe you're better off not making a decision, because your perception of the situation is often changed by that desire or that anger. There could be a mood that sets in that affects your thinking and your view of things. The Buddha said it was useful to be aware of the presence of your state of mind, the mood, the general state that's present. And there's always a state of mind. Sometimes it's very subtle. There's a famous story that's told in our circles about a woman who came to a teacher on a retreat and said, "I'm having some kind of experience. I don't know what it is. It's really weird. I never had this before. I don't have a word for it." And then she came back for the next interview and said, "I discovered what it was. It's calm. I've never been calm in my life, so I couldn't identify it. But lo and behold, it's calm." So to learn, it's very useful to start paying attention to the state of mind that we're in, different times of our life. There's always a state of mind. So when you're driving your car, what state of mind are you driving your car in? When you're going to answer the telephone, what state of mind are you answering the telephone in? When you go shopping, what state of mind are you in? When you're going to talk to someone about some kind of conflict resolution you have to deal with, what state of mind are you in as you go into there? Are you apprehensive? Are you afraid? Are you angry? What's the state of mind which is coloring and filtering the ways in which you might perceive the situation, the ways in which you might react to the situation? Your state of mind is always something happening at present moment. What's the state of mind that's affecting your mindfulness practice while you're sitting on the cushion? To take into account the state of mind that you're sitting in. What's a state of mind that's arisen as you're sitting here? Maybe you're getting bored as you're sitting here, or restless. Some people are very diligent in being mindful, whatever arises, but boredom about the practice, restlessness about the practice, that's about the practice, so they don't have to pay attention to that. So then the boredom or the restlessness takes over. Oh, forget this. I'm bored. And so the boredom then makes the decision to get up and go buy PlayStation 2. So paying attention to states of mind And part of this was very interesting. The Buddha recommended not only you be aware of the state of mind that's present, but when it goes away, be aware of what it's like when it's gone. So essentially pay attention to the absence of something. So when you're angry, be aware that you're angry. But when the anger passes, spend some time getting to know what it feels like that it's now no longer there. When you're concentrated, be aware you're concentrated. When the concentration is no longer there, when the mind is no longer stable or settled or calm, be aware of what it's like when it's not there anymore. And you can learn kind of retrospectively. You can learn a little bit by comparing the presence of states of mind versus the absence of it. What does it feel like when something's no longer there? What does it feel like when it is there? What are the different feeling of being in a body, depending on what's there and what's not there? Then the fourth frame of reference, the fourth foundation of mindfulness, is called the foundation of mindfulness of dharmas. And dharmas are a little bit harder to translate into English. Sometimes it's translated as the objects of mind, but I don't think that does justice to the word. There might not be any word that does justice to the word dharma, dhamma. But I'm fond of translating into English as the knowables, that which can be known. But when you look at what the Buddha actually talked about, he gave five different exercises or frames of reference within the fourth foundation of mindfulness. Five areas of your life that's also useful to pay attention to. Once you're in the present moment, start noticing these different aspects. The first three aspects is those places where the mind stops, or where the mind gets entangled, ties itself up. Or that those areas of the mind which make it difficult for you to be attentive, the barriers to being attentive, that which hinders your being attentive. So the first is the five hindrances. So what it means is that when you find it hard to be attentive, when you find that your mind drifts off and you're not present, you need also to bring attention to noticing what gets in the way of attention, the traps of awareness, where your awareness gets lost. You want in mindfulness practice become real expert at what are your particular tendencies of getting lost. What are the forces that tend to pull you away out of awareness? And you have to do this at work for yourself. You can read a list and memorize it and kind of say it in the abstract. This is what tends to happen. But each of us is different. And we have to become aware of our own particular tendencies. And that means that you're supposed to become aware of it. In a sense, it's supposed to happen then. So don't judge yourself negatively for it happening. Take it as an opportunity. Oh, when you get lost in desire, which is the first hindrance, start developing your investigation on your desiring so you can become so familiar with it that you become stronger than it so it doesn't become a barrier to awareness. Aversion. Some people are more the aversion type. Notice how aversion functions as a barrier to awareness and see if you can overcome that barrier. Restlessness and anxiety is a barrier to awareness. Notice how that functions as a barrier and see if you can overcome that barrier. Sloth and torpor, boredom and lethargy. Notice how that becomes a barrier. And then doubt. Notice how doubt is a barrier. The next one is the knots. Great word, isn't it? The knots. How we get tied up. How does awareness get tied? How does the mind get tied up in the things of the world, the objects of awareness, so the awareness is not fluid and open anymore to receive the next moment? You hear the sound of the rain. It isn't just sound of the rain nicely on the roof, but you get entangled with that experience. I wonder if I can tape record that sound. It's been so nice, my meditation, to hear that nice sound. And maybe if I would tape record it, then I can play it during my sittings at home. And maybe I can even get it piped into PlayStation 2 while I'm playing my games. You know, it'd be really nice. And so suddenly you're lost and entangled, engaged, involved with the sound of the rain. It isn't just sound of the rain. The mind gets itself entangled in all kinds of things. The knees hurt. And it isn't just simply the knees hurt, thank you, but rather you get entangled that experience of the knees hurting. I have to fix it. This means something is wrong. This means I'm not meditating right. This means that my legs are going to fall off. This means that, we start hating it. We get entangled with it. So we have to start noticing. One of the useful areas of attention, the Buddha said, start noticing how you get entangled with your experience. Notice the knots. It's by noticing how you get entangled that you can realistically become untangled. Some people like to do spiritual bypasses, where they say, oh, becoming calm and peaceful is a great thing, let's just do it. You know, like magic wand, boom, you're peaceful. Whatever, but you force yourself to be peaceful, or you try to make your mind still and placid. The way of the Buddha, I think, is more realistic. You need to become aware of the forces that keep you from being peaceful. And it means, again, it's a very realistic form of mindfulness. You establish yourself in the present moment, and you become familiar with what's actually happening in the present. You don't try to make something different happen. And then the third area is to be aware of the various ways in which we create a self-identity. How we take something to be mine. Me, mine, myself. It's another way mind gets knotted up. It's not necessary. It's an extra movement of the mind to say, this is mine. Or this is who I am. Anything that's kind of started with a preface, I am, and then we fill in the blank, is an extra thought and movement of the mind. You don't need to make the idea, I am anything, or this is mine, in the depths of your sitting. It's useful pragmatically to get around the world to have those notions. But can you let go of them, at least when you're meditating, and have an experience where you're not associating what's happening with me, mine, and myself? So the Buddha talked about some of the various places in which we might get caught up, me, mine, myself. In our body, our feelings, our perceptions, our dispositions and thoughts and ideas and motivations, states of mind, consciousness. Our awareness are all areas in which we take me as me, mine, myself. So he says it's useful to notice this tendency we have. Mind making, me making. Mind-making. And then the Buddha said it's useful to pay attention to, and that's the first three, and then there's five exercises in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. The fourth one is pay attention to the seven factors of awakening. Finally, you get to pay attention to something besides the knots and the barriers, the difficulties. It's useful to notice the presence of mindfulness when you're mindful. It's useful to notice the presence of investigation when you're investigating. It's useful to notice the presence of energy, effort, when you're making effort in practice, when effort is there and energy is there in your practice. So you might be sitting after lunch and you're sleepy. There's lack of energy. Then later on, maybe you wake up and you feel the body's energized again and alert. To recognize that and notice it, the Buddha said it was useful. There might be concentration. Notice the concentration. There might be tranquility. Notice the tranquility. There might be joy present. If there's joy present, it's really useful to acknowledge it and recognize it. Don't be quick to overlook your joy, but really be there for it. Recognize that. And when there's equanimity, notice the equanimity. The seven factors of awakening feed on your awareness. The more you can notice them without attachment or clinging or expectation, just to notice they're there, it tends to kind of nourish them and let them grow. And then the fifth area is to notice the foundations of mindfulness. This is another frame of reference that it's useful to look at our life with. Notice when you're suffering. And see if you can notice the cause of that suffering. Look and see if it's possible to end suffering. And see if you can, and then think of pragmatic ways, the path to bring suffering to an end. Now, if you do these four foundations of mindfulness, if you begin exploring and investigating the present moment, first you have to get yourself in the present, which is a beautiful thing to do, and then start exploring, getting to know what's happening in the present moment. As you do this, the Buddha says at the end of the sutra, he gives a guarantee. I've always wondered about this guarantee, but he gives a guarantee. He says, if you do this, I think he starts off by saying, for 7 years. No, not even for 7 years. If you do it for 7 months. Not even for 7 months. If you do it for 7 weeks. No, not even for 7 weeks. If you do it for 7 days, you will have one of two results. You'll be fully liberated in the present moment, in the present life, or you'll become a once-returner, which is basically the same thing. I think what he meant was, if you can do it for 7 days, non-stop, fully, completely, thoroughly, you're allowed to go to sleep. But most of us can't, if you can really stay in the present moment, with that thoroughness, real thoroughness, completeness, not let the mind wander, it doesn't take much, 7 days. It's a great promise, I guess. But anyway, for most of us, we're not so thorough. And part of the great quest of mindfulness practice is the quest of learning how to be more peaceful, more insightful, more understanding about what goes on in our life, more accepting of our life as it is. And we find ourselves no longer at war with ourselves, in conflict with ourselves. So that's the four foundations of mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Maybe now that if you've never read it, maybe now as you've heard me give kind of a commentary on it, maybe if you read it, it'll make more sense. It's considered by some people one of the most important discourses of the Buddha. So I thank you very much for this wonderful day, and I hope it was nice for you to be here. I hope that it was wonderful, even if it was difficult, that you appreciate the power of meeting yourself and confronting yourself and being present for yourself, even when you'd rather be at PlayStation 2. So, thank you. The next one-day sitting that I'm going to be teaching is in December, I think December 2nd. But the next one-day sitting that our sitting group is putting on is Shaila Trumovich is going to do a one-day sitting in November. 18th. For people who are ages 39 and under. So if you're of that age, you're kind of a young person's retreat. And you might want to come for that wonderful day that Shaila will teach. And also, we could use a little bit of help cleaning up. Not much we need, but some people could stay behind and help kind of sweep the floor. It goes pretty quick. And also to empty the trash cans and just check the toilets and stuff. And if you can come and talk to Andrea here, who managed the day, then she will tell you where things are. And where